My name is Jennifer Anju Grossman. My friends and colleagues call me JAG. I'm the CEO of the Atlas Society, and we are doing a Clubhouse Ask Me Anything with our founder, David Kelly. I'm also joined by my colleague, Scott Schiff. And we have a load of questions that have come in on Instagram, where we have, I think, 66,000 is our latest. It's growing every week, 66,000 followers. And those are fun, but the way we handle those on Instagram is questions come in and we post 1 minute answers. And of course, that is inadequate to really being able to unpack some of these questions. So of course, we'll prioritize any questions from the audience. So please raise your hand and we will get to as many of your questions as we can. And we've got a question from Lawrence. So, hey, Lawrence. And it might be one of those days where you have to sign out and sign back in.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Perfect. All right. Hi, David.
Hey,
so question I have for you is actually sort of a follow-up to one that I previously gave Rob on Tuesday, and it was in regards to borders and countries and immigration policy. And the reason I brought it up is just because I've been hearing a lot of different conversations from people on this issue. And sort of a follow-up that I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on and hear the more of an objectivist perspective is, if a country like the United States, people come in and say it was founded upon ideas instead of, you know, racial or blood identity, was more on certain principles, then doesn't such a country, I guess the term would be almost, you know, if people are going to enter that country, they have to sort of understand that social contract and be willing to adopt it. But it seems that there's a lot of arguments that these things don't need to happen anymore. People should be free to roam from country to country as they please. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Is there some sort of keeping that is necessary within a country, or is it we more open to just promoting the ideas as people enter?
Well, that's a good question and a hard one. Let's start with the basic principles. In a free society, people should be free to cross borders, subject to certain conditions like criminal background or contagious disease, that would, you know, are legitimate reasons for keeping people out. And with also the condition that, you know, a nation ruled by a government has to be have some information about who's in the country. So I don't have any objection to, you know, when you enter the country, enter through a legal spot and a legal entryway, and just register and then come on in, go about your business. That now, that said, of course, our immigration laws put all kinds of restrictions on, in numerical restrictions on what, how many people from each part of the world can are allowed in, and that's why there are huge waiting lists and so such such an incentive for illegal immigration. But that's the principle, with subject to a few constraints. People should be free to cross borders. But as you say, America is not founded on ethnic identity, religion, or race, or anything else. It is founded on the ideas, and it was unique in history, and to some extent still is in that regard. And I believe strongly in that American founding, and that as the civic religion, so to speak, that is our culture. That is the national political culture that America created, and you know, it should still obtain. And that's reflected, it can be reflected in citizenship. To get citizenship, you have to, you know, go through the, you have to wait, and then there's a test. And the test is, includes, I haven't seen the test in a long time, maybe it's changed, but it used to include enough civic knowledge about, you know, the structure of the U.S. government, the Bill of Rights, and so forth, that you at least have to understand and pledge your allegiance to become a voting citizen, a full member of the society. And I think that's a good idea too. but combining those principles is not easy because people come with all kinds of ideas. And over the 250, 300 years of our existence, people have come in with very different ideas. Part of the reason we have a mixed welfare state today is large numbers of immigrants from Europe in the late 19th century who were already, you know, which was already moving toward socialism, came in with those ideas and became part of the progressive movement. And so, but there's no good solution for that except persuasion and hopefully education by teachers who are committed to, at least in teaching civics, teaching politics, understand and will convey those ideas to students. Now, all that said, the vast welfare state we have, there's a, you know, an ongoing constant issue of people, the allegation anyway, that people are coming to get welfare. Years ago, decades ago, actually, when I wrote about this, that was not, I found statistical data that undermined that claim. I don't know what the situation is today. And there's lots of room for debate and also reform on eligibility for welfare. But I do think, I just go back to my principles and first, freedom of movement, and secondly, American exceptional, the American quote-unquote civic religion that makes us unique. And I think those, if you start there, you at least have, you know, the way to navigate the more detailed issues of immigration today.
Awesome. Tom.
Before we get to the next question, thank you, Lawrence. That was a great question. And I look forward to Tom to your question too. But I want to just say something. As regulars on this Clubhouse venue know, I do one of a Clubhouse every month, as do many of the other scholars. And I sometimes do Ask Me Anything. These are fun, and it just because I get to deal with the unexpected in real time. But also, I do like to, you know, cover specified topics that I'm going to cover. And so I'm looking for topics for the fall, and I'm writing down some of these issues. But if anyone has a particular request, those of you who are live on this call, please feel free to say, hey, could you do a Clubhouse on that? I won't make any promises, but I'll make a note. Thanks. So, Tom, go ahead.
Tom, can you unmute? Tom may be having issues. We can go to Professor Hill while Tom's getting that fixed.
Yeah, Tom, because I don't see the mute button, you might need to do what Lawrence did, which is just sign out and sign back in. But we have another scholar, Professor Jason Hill is here with us.
Hi, Jag. Hi, Scott. Hi, David. David, this should be a question right up your alley. In preparation for my Clubhouse talk that I'm giving tomorrow, which is on living in the age of nihilism, which is a huge topic, I can't talk about every single form of nihilism. There is cosmic, existential, metaphysical nihilism, moral nihilism. You know, I've decided to talk about, just to give a heads up, about epistemological nihilism. And David, I'm wondering if you could sort of distinguish between, well, epistemological nihilism is a form of skepticism that says that knowledge at all does not exist. It has no basis in reality. There is no referent that we can point to that would corroborate knowledge. And epistemological fallibilism, which says that there is knowledge, but it's uncertain. So I'd probably put Kant in that direction. There is human knowledge, but human reason and other faculties that we have for apprehending knowledge are unreliable. And I want to say, I'm going to sort of elicit your help here for my talk tomorrow. If you think that epistemological fallibilism, that is the idea that knowledge is uncertain, doesn't in the end lead us to some kind of nihilism, epistemological nihilism, because if we undercut reason as a faculty for obtaining certainty in the knowledge realm, it leads to a kind of radical skepticism, and the logical terminal point of that radical skepticism seems to me like something like epistemological nihilism, where we're just going to say, I can't account for any knowledge that I have, even if it's a justified belief. If it's going to become so radically skepticized, then I can't call it knowledge. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I agree basically that there's a downward spiral through at least the common forms of fallibilism to skepticism to nihilism, and which is the dead end and incoherent, because any claim of nihilism claims to be asserting something that's distinct from non-nihilism, i.e. it at least assumes the law of non-contradiction. it's an assertion that's put forward as true. And not just the opinion of the person speaking. There's some people like solipsists who say, oh, it's just my opinion. And then the thing is, you still ask, where did you get your opinions? And so one issue here is the primacy of existence. All of our cognitive activity is oriented toward a world that is not created by the mind. And that's why Kant is on the wrong side of the tracks on that count, because of his belief that we can't ever know reality as it is, only the phenomena that are partly constituted by our own cognitive capacity. But people who believe anything like that tend to invent some new form of objectivity, some new standard. And Kant's case, it was, the most common answer is, well, it's universal agreement among people. That is, we all agree on something. It's a kind of, you know, social relativism, of which there are many problems. But let me go back to, the hard nut here is fallibilism, because that is an effort, I think, or can be understood as an effort to understand something that is correct. Because of our conceptual capacities for going beyond the direct evidence of our senses, it involves concepts, it involves induction, it involves deduction, inferences that we put together and to acquire knowledge of things way, way beyond what we can directly see, hear, or touch. And I mean, that's the immense power of the human mind. but it carries with it the risk of error, because unlike perception is not subject to error. You see what you see what the world and your sensory apparatus give rise to causally, and you're always seeing something. that there's always something there, even if you, if you're in unusual circumstances and can't identify it conceptually or identify it wrong, like looking at the bent stick in water and saying it's bent. But I heard a story about a philosophy professor teaching epistemology who had a, you know, glass of water with a stick in it. And of course, all the students knew the it was just an illusion. And then at the end of the class or the end of semester, he pulled out the stick and it actually was bent. That is one of the more destructive things, teaching techniques I've ever heard. But anyway, but so you have to admit the possibility of error. And that means that we need an epistemology, epistemological methods for keeping our conclusions open to further evidence as it entails. But it does not mean there's no certainty. There are many things we're certain about. I'm certain that I'm talking right now. And I'm pretty certain, Jason, that you are listening because I'm hearing you. You're still on the call. There are many, many things, a vast number of things of which we're totally certain. It's the fallibilism, I think, is taking issues at, or building its case around issues at the frontiers of knowledge in science and other areas, or areas like history where they're so complicated that, it's hard to find a, something like history, or even more, one of the things, another of your fields, aesthetic judgment. We can't rule out wrong interpretation or compare them by doing experiments, by doing quantitative tests. So there is, in those realms, I think fallibilism is trying to do something valid, which is opposing dogmatism, the just closed-minded refusal to consider any evidence or any counter argument against the position you happen to believe. But it's, as a general epistemology, it's taken way out of context, and it would be undermined if everything was fallible. We couldn't trust anything. If I couldn't be certain that I'm speaking, you're listening, that there are cars on the street outside my window, that I live on the 9th floor of a building in Washington, D.C. I mean, we could all go on and on with the things that we are absolutely certain of. And so if certainty in as such is impossible, that means cognition, knowledge is impossible. Awareness of reality is impossible. And that contradicts itself. That is, that's the best I can do. The question of certainty and openness to further evidence is a hard one in epistemology, I'll admit it. I've worked on it for many years and don't feel I have the final, well, maybe in philosophy is another one where talking about final answers is hard. But anyway, I don't have the best theory, the theory about it that I would like to have. But nevertheless, I would urge you to not take the straightforward universal kind of fallibilism that I know people have advocated, and limit the idea or reformulate the idea as openness to evidence. So I could go on, but let me stop there, Jason, see if that got to your point.
It is helpful. I'll stop here because I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. It is helpful. I'm just worried that even in areas where verifiability is very, very difficult, that it does tend toward a kind of agnosticism regarding knowledge that in the end leaves us even skeptical about axioms like existence, identity, and consciousness. Because those are things that can't be proven. So how would the fallibist, epistemological fallibist, deal with phenomena that are unprovable. We just have to sort of accept them. So there's a kind of agnosticism that I see there that still leaves me a little bit uncomfortable. But thanks for the clarification, and I'll take this up a little bit in more depth tomorrow.
Okay, I'll look forward to that. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason. Also wanted to acknowledge we have another one of our senior scholars, Professor Richard Salzman, is in the room. So we got quite the banner team here today. Tom.
Oh, thank you. I hope you can hear me now. And thank you, David, for hosting this session. I didn't know that it's once a month. But in any case, I had a theme when I composed my set of questions. So if you want to defer this to some other time, that's fine. It is on the nature of thought and its correspondence to facts. And I had three questions. I followed this pretty much based on what you had with Patterson in Pursuit, episode 61 and 76 back in 2017 with Stephen Patterson. And I thought, maybe David should have more of those meetings, but it never came to fruition. So here I am with some of these questions. And the first one I have is on modal propositions and the many world idea. I think you mentioned this once before, back perhaps in the perennial questions, cassettes or CDs that I used to have. So you talked about that, but I like a little more elaboration on that, if you could provide that. Second one is on the metaphysical, epistemological, and hybrid possibilities that you would allude to the idea of facts and how we see certainty when we have more information and non-negative, I mean, no counterfactuals. So I like that elaboration. Third one is on hypothetical propositions and as well as disjunctive propositions, because if I understand what Somers is saying, they are negative valence. And what is the structure of the proposition with respect to fact that they give us? And fourth one is on future and past.
May need the chance to kind of go through these first three. If we have time to do those three, David, I'll defer to you.
Yeah, I think I know the fourth question, like future propositions. There's a famous famous example called Aristotle's Sea Battle. I don't know if that's what you were getting at, Tom, but all right, let me run through these quickly. These are huge topics, and Tom, you are obviously very deeply thoughtful and educated about these topics. So, and I won't be able to address them at your level fully, but let me just say something. Modal propositions are ones like statement P is possible, it is necessary, impossible, contradictory. These can be formulated in propositional logic and in different ways through truth tables. But the point is, from an objectivist standpoint, when think about the possible versus the necessary, philosophers like to talk about possible worlds. Well, there's only one possible world, the real one. Possibility is something that exists within the world as a capacity for action on the part of an entity that's capable of doing that action, but isn't now. Salt is soluble right now, even if I'm not dropping it in water. So it's possible for salt to dissolve. It's not possible for whatever else. I think it's gold that won't dissolve. Anyway, that whole idea is of possible worlds is wrong. And modal concepts like possible and necessary are useful only within the metaphysics of realism, which is there's a world and whatever is true of and in that world. Your second question about facts, this is interesting because I wrote a paper some years ago that we've used as a discussion basis for long discussions. There's no way I can summarize the point. But
I read that paper.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well, then maybe we should just have a separate conversation or email exchange about that, because even to give the rest of the audience an idea of what the issue is, it would take the rest of this hour. Hypothetical and disjunctive propositions. Hypothetical ones are like if P, then Q. Disjunctive propositions, P or Q. We use these all the time. If-then statements are used to identify causal relationships. If the barometer is very high, rain is likely, et cetera. And disjunctive ones are, you know, someone has a baby, it's either a boy or a girl, but we don't know. So we need these terms, but they are the logic of them and the confirmation of them depends on the P and Q, the constituent elements, and a broader context of information that, like in the case of a birth, we know that people give rise only to two, you know, humans come in two sexes, like most these mammals and other orders of animal life. And so we know in advance from that vast biological context that it's one or the other. But if we don't know which, that's all we can say. That's a short topic. The analysis of that or integration of those kinds of compound propositions are called into my analysis of facts is not something I've done completed yet. It's high on my list. I'm working on going back to that paper and working on it. So maybe we've gone into, you know, even as briefly as my answer was, maybe we've gone into enough depth. But I invite you to send questions. I'm particularly interested that you're familiar with Fred Summer's work. But let's leave it there for now.
All right. Yes. And Tom, we'll have David on once a month. Of course, we're also going to have at our annual gala coming up in October, we're going to have a seminars with all of our scholars, and that will be another opportunity to network and discuss some of these issues at greater length. So you can check out that link above if you are in the Southern California area or willing to join us there. So, JP, you changed your profile pic, looking very sharp.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Well, that was way above my armchair level philosophy, but I am very much interested in something that David said after Jason announced his room, which is bound to be very, very pertinent to what I'm diving on. But my question to you, David, when you mentioned that that persuasion is really the only ethical maybe way to go. I was having a conversation with it was a room here in Clubhouse, and they were all Kantians, and they were all postmodern, and they were all discussing all these truth, talking about your truth, my truth, and how they all loved each other, and they were. They were tolerating every single worldview as valid and needing its own space and its own treatment, which is so ridiculous. But I mean, I was stomaching this whole thing, and I was thinking, how do you persuade a doctrine, because it's doctrine. When I engaged with someone there, and he got a little bit heated, he said that, well, that's your truth, and you are, I respect your view, and I love you, and I was, it was even offensive to have that said to me, because it was all simply dismissing me. And we're going with this narrative, and but well, that's exactly what I mean. I said, it's very convenient for someone in authority to give you a narrative and say, this is reality, and this is why you guys believe in such ridiculous things, because if it comes from authority, you will believe it, because that's the go-to. You're not expected to have a brain. You're not expected to use your own reason. And even when you say I am, I mean, you're acknowledging being right there. It's you're conscious of yourself. So you have certainty. You have certainty of things. And they were saying, going on, no. So it was very frustrating. And I guess I would love to have an anecdote from you and on a episode in your life in which you were able to persuade. Thank you.
Oh, gosh. I wish I could give you a good one. I have, in my work on epistemology and years and years of explaining the primacy of existence and why it's different from the primacy of consciousness, which is what the people you're talking about were embracing. There are some classic arguments. It's called the self-refutation arguments, which go to the effect you're saying that your what you believe is true only for you, and what's true, what I believe is true for me. Well, what I want to ask is, that sounds like a universal statement. Everyone's truth is true for that person. Are you saying that? That's a universal statement about all people. And it's a statement about you live in a reality with other people. There's lots of other things besides people and minds, but other people are part of the world, and you're making a universal claim about something that you are asserting is true. Is it true just because you believe it? So that if I say, well, no, I don't think it, we all have our separate truths. I think there's one world and one truth. And so you're wrong. Your truth is not true. It's false. Is that then true for me? So you're saying my beliefs are true for me. My world exists for me. And I'm saying, no, it doesn't. So that's my belief. Is that true for me? Now, these arguments, I think, are logically decisive and are almost completely unpersuasive to people who that one's talking about. When I was in graduate school, I was writing a PhD thesis about this, and I had a very smart advisor who tended to that view, and so I ran all these arguments by him, and he always had some comeback. So I'd go away and I'd come back and answer this comeback, and you'd have another comeback. It goes on and on and on. But so refutation is probably not the best thing. It's probably not even possible. Because if someone does not accept, for example, that there's a world there, if someone does not accept that the law of identity is universal across for anything in the world and for any human being trying to understand the world, if someone doesn't accept that, there's no argument. There's no argument. You can't go anywhere with that. What you can do, maybe, if someone is more or less innocently mistaken, and I don't think most of these people are, but for someone who's innocently confused about it, just ask, why do you believe that? And then, if you invite an answer to that, that will tell you something about whether the person is just responding to the authority of postmodernism, the intellectual authority that it has today, or is sorry, genuinely confused. And but if you ask, why do you believe that? Even, hey, that's interesting. Why do you believe that? What made you think that? And invite someone to think. In the course of thinking, they're going to have to give reasons, use logic, maybe point to things in the world, like there's typical, lots of classical skeptical arguments, like we have perceptual illusions, or it's possible to be wrong when we thought we were right. And you can go through those. There are answers to those things. But so persuasion may be possible in some cases. But refutation, I would step back from attempting to refute it. If someone does not be willing to engage in explanation and explain this position, then there's no point in the discussion. It can't happen. Nothing. There's no progress possible. I mean, there's certain things that are just, if someone doesn't accept the canons of logic, the law of identity and non-contradiction, and ultimately the primacy of existence. All the very foundations for thinking about epistemology or any topic don't exist. They're undermined. It's like, you know, going to a doctor and saying, I'm not going to take your advice because I believe in a witch doctor. Well, okay, then there's nothing I can do for you.
That would have been, I should have channeled that way. Brilliant. Thank you, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as I promised, we have the all-star team here. Professor Stephen Hicks has joined us up here on stage and may have some insights into this. Or did you have a separate question for David, Stephen? And also, we have been experiencing this issue on this clubhouse for whatever reason. So, Stephen, you might just need to sign out and sign back in. And meanwhile, I see Richard, who has a mute button, so he's able to unmute.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Just let me interrupt for a second. I hope Stephen does come back because he can give a much better, fuller answer, more informed answer about nihilism than I can. In regard to Jason's question. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Very well, David. This is a great session. And I have a question. Feel free to say I have no idea what you're talking about, Richard, and we'll talk offline. But I've long been curious whether you think there's any legitimacy to the concept and method called abduction, ABDUCT, as opposed to induction and deduction. And from what the reason this interests me is I do economic and investment forecasting. And so, yes, I want to know the laws of deduction and induction, but mostly I'm interested in inference, in forecasting and the probabilistic aspects of it. And, you know, there's a lot of literature on what's called Bayesian inference and, you know, sequentially updating our forecast based on what we already know. But I've come across in recent years this concept called abduction. And it apparently began with Charles Peirce, the pragmatist philosopher. And it offers principles for inferring things, but without having absolute certainty. So one example that's commonly given is you hear that Tom and Harry ended their friendship. But then 2 weeks later, you see them jogging together, and that's all you know. And you infer that they made up, that the friendship has been repaired in some way. But it's clearly not a full confirmation, didn't investigate, didn't ask them. And yet, if you have to make inferences like that, well, we do all the time. We have to infer certain things. So that's all I have. I'm just asking whether you ever came across it in all your studies of epistemology, and whether you think it's even a valid, kind of like third way besides deduction and induction to knowing things and inferring things.
Well, no, I don't think it's a third way. Abduction, yes, as you mentioned, was introduced by Pierce. And what it normally means is inference to the best explanation. So it's broadly inductive. It's contrasted with induction, usually what the person means is that induction is limited to generalization from a sample. I see a bunch of swans are all white. I infer all swans are white. Whereas induction to the best explanation is broader. A scientific theory normally takes into account a range of things that it's trying to explain and a range of data, experimental and other data, that control what the possible alternatives are. And, the typical method is you think of what are the possible explanations for this phenomenon? I can come up with three that are consistent with the evidence. So I try to have an experiment that will distinguish between them and confirm one over the others. But that's also known as, the hypothetical deductive method in philosophy of science. Mm-hmm. Abduction comes down to a more general process of inquiry that we use for more complicated questions, where it's not a simple extrapolation from the sample, but it takes into account a number of factors, like, originally the views of the solar system that emerged from Copernicus to Newton. They gathered more and more evidence from different sources and eventually came up with the hypothesis and Newton's laws of gravitation as the best explanation, and still for most things the best today, for why objects, physical objects in space move as they do. Or another example that I recently was writing about, Sherlock Holmes stories. Mm-hmm. I love Sherlock Holmes.
So do I.
Stories are abductive. He's gathering evidence, and usually there's a false hypothesis by Lestrade or one of the other detectives that he knows it's not compatible with some fact or other, and then he comes up with the best explanation. It's not, still subject to further evidence if it comes along. So it's inductive, but in the broad sense.
Yeah, the Perry Masons are done that way as well. Okay, that's helpful, David. I wanted to make sure I wasn't misinterpreting it as, like a bridge between deduction and induction. And actually, the way it's not really a bridge. In two cases, you said relates to deduction, and then also induction. So I'm wondering whether it's a third helpful way of trying to know things. And it doesn't sound like you're saying it's a total goofball idea from the pragmatist. You're saying it falls in either one of the other camps, and it's not a third way. I don't want to extend this, but just want to make sure I get that.
Although I should add that abduction as a process for, choosing the best explanation often involves deductive elements. Mm. We have an hypothesis, and we say, if that's true, then X must follow. Let's test and see if X is the case. That's a deductive argument. So there are components of both in it, but it's inductive because it is based on a finite amount of evidence available. And Sherlock Holmes is another great example. His abductions are based on a whole string of deductive arguments. I saw this ash. I know this ash, or I saw this tattoo on a man's arm. Yeah. I know that tattoo is only done in China, so the man was in China.
But also, as the stories roll out, the new evidence comes in, so he also revises with new data. So that sounds more inductive. Okay, thank you, David. That was great. Thank you. That really helps. Thanks.
Great.
And Stephen is back. I'm going to start. If I don't see a mute button on somebody, I'll send a separate message to let them know.
Okay.
So working out these kids.
All right, yeah, enjoying all of these epistemological questions. But I wanted to ask an intellectual biography question of you, David, one that I've wondered about once in a while. Your graduate school days, when you were working on your dissertation and you took courses at Princeton, I know Richard Rorty was your professor and the advisor for your dissertation. And since Rorty was such a giant name in the last generation in American and world philosophy, or if you had just some recollections of what he was like as a teacher, as a dissertation advisor, that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, Rorty passed away some years ago. At the time I knew him, he was in the analytic philosophy camp at Princeton, as was everyone else at Princeton almost. But he was also, reading Heidegger and Dewey and other things, and he became much more of a, they became much more central in his life afterwards. But the things that I worked on him with had to do with epistemologists of the time, like Quine, the logician, Sellers, Wilfred Sellers, and the issues of empiricism and foundationalism. That is, the foundationalism is the issue of whether there is a foundation for knowledge, something that a starting point. And empiricists say, of course, there is perception, but there was a lot of skepticism about that. So anyway, but he was, I opposed pretty much everything he stood for and vice versa. He was a great teacher. He was open, interested. When I wrote my thesis, I'm not bragging here because it's just his opinion, but he said, if there's a defense of foundationalism, I think you have it. That's the best thing I've seen. So he would say things like that. And it worked very hard to get his students into, to their first academic jobs. He wrote letters of recommendation and talked with colleagues. And, he was already very well known. One of the great ironies was that at the time I was studying with him, he wrote a paper called The World Well Lost, which is why philosophy has no legitimate intellectual function. It is just a conversation of ideas. It doesn't add anything to the knowledge of science and everything. And yet, he was one of the best advisors, and people sought him out because of that. He was a great advisor. And always seemed to me like an irony. He thinks philosophy is, kind of a not very productive discipline, but he was so helpful in getting his students into philosophy. So anyway, this is an interesting guy.
Oh, yeah, thanks for that. Fascinating.
Yes, thanks. Nice to remember.
Nice to hear that background. SK, welcome to the stage. Are you able to unmute, SK? You may need to leave and come back if you're unable to.
Otherwise, let's take a question from our trove of Instagram questions. Okay, here's one asking, it's Averick Balsanian, isn't everyone selfish?
No. Short answer. Long answer. Longer answer. That claim is known in philosophy as psychological egoism, the idea that everyone actually is selfish. And I believe objectivism has, it's been pointed out many, many times before, and not just objectivists, but many other philosophers, it doesn't get to the essence. When you say that everyone is self-interested, you're assuming simply that their interest is defined by whatever they want to do, by whatever motive they have, including whatever values they're trying to seek. So even an altruist who gives money to the poor, or Mother Teresa who spends her life in poverty among poor, sick people, is doing what she wanted to do because of her altruist beliefs, and she's getting self-esteem out of it. But none of that gets to the real question about interest. Interest is not whatever you want to do. Interest is what is in your interest objectively. By the standard for objectivists, the standard of promoting your life. Some things promote it, some things don't. And if you choose the things that don't, you're not being selfish, not truly. And in that respect, there are genuine altruists who are elevating other people to a status above themselves and engaging in sacrifice, which is not egoistic. So the ethical egoism starts with some standard of what your self-interest is, and then from there asks what under what conditions are people actually pursuing their self-interest as so understood. So I can refer people to other sources on this. Nathaniel Brandon wrote, I think there's something in the Virtue of Selfishness book, Isn't Everyone Selfish, which I'd recommend. It gives the answer, essentially the same answer I just did.
Great. I've got one here. Do you think it's time to get rid of the death penalty?
I don't have a... I have mixed feelings about it. I don't have a clear conception, but let me just say what the two, two main considerations are. One is, I think there are people that things people do, killing, especially the more brutal forms of killing, rape, even, that involves, certainly rape with murder. That really deserve that the person is saying, my actions convey that I don't have any respect for human rights, and that means he's forfeiting his own. And so, on a scale of punishment, I think, that goes from shoplifting to murder, and the death penalty I have no moral problem with it. What I do have is a problem that proving guilt, establishing guilt beyond a certainty of a doubt, in that case where a person's life is at stake, is I worry that we don't have the culture of rationality that juries would need, that would provide us with juries who are totally committed to objectivity. I think that was Ayn Rand's reservation as well. So I don't know how all of that falls out.
That's fair.
I just when I see people getting certainly the whole system of parole, even for really for serial murders. They should all get life without parole. Without possibility of parole, at least. So, anyway, that hard question.
Okay. Professor Hicks, did you have another question you wanted to add?
Yes, I do. I actually wanted to follow up on Dr. Salzman's question about abduction. I liked David's answer to it. But what about this hypothesis when I've thought about abduction, that the abduction is not a third logical form separate from induction and deduction, but rather it is a psychological variant, that in both induction and deduction, you start with some premises and you're looking for the conclusion that follows from them. But when we are doing explanation, and you said it's a species of inference of the best explanation, what we have, in effect, is the conclusion, but we're looking for the best set of premises that are going to derive that conclusion. So it's the same logic in both cases, but in one case, you're starting with premises and you're trying to derive logically the conclusion. But in the other case, abduction, you have the conclusion and you're asking what explains it. And so what are the premises that do so? You know, so for example, I can say, you know, if I know all humans are mortal as a premise, and I know Socrates is a human, and I say, well, what follows from this? And then my logic will tell me that Socrates is a mortal. But then if we started the other way, you know, we find Socrates is dead, and we say, hey, whoa, Socrates is a mortal. What explains this? And then we would backtrack and say, well, you know, it's a fact that all humans are mortal and Socrates was a human. So in both cases, it's the same logic, but we are psychologically approaching the same trio or set of fact premises and conclusions from a different direction.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Stephen. It's an angle I had never thought of. You know, it does relate to that, you know, my logic book and most logic books, the point is made that inference goes from premises to conclusion. In explanation, it goes the opposite way. You start with a fact and you're trying to find out the hypothesis that explains a fact. And it's really two ways. I mean, there you can still talk about the premises. A lot of the same standards still apply to explanation that apply to inference. My only reservation, and I have to think about this, is that searching for the best explanation is a cognitive device. We want to know, we're trying to answer the question, what is the cause or the underlying reasons that this observable event or phenomenon exists or happened? And so we end up with a cognitive structure. And for example, you know, take my solar system example. Now we have knowledge that the solar system operates as it does, 9 planets in elliptical orbits, et cetera. But initially we had just observations of stars, the sun, et cetera. I think there's a psychological difference. Let me leave it there because I haven't thought about it. It's a great point. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, you were asking about ideas for future shows. That could be its own topic.
Can I interject here just briefly?
Sure.
Stephen, it seems to me, and David, that to go the psychological route, there would have to be some kind of gaping lacunae in the sampling so that you're giving an interpretation that goes way outside the evidence that one could really plausibly, reasonably infer inductively. So it seems, Stephen, that when we are involved in an abduction, that we're still working plausibly and reasonably with evidence within the sampling that doesn't commit us to going too far outside an interpretational schema. It's psychological, seems like, okay, Brent and Harry broke up last week. I see them running. They made up. That seems more psychological because we don't have enough evidence. I think there needs to be some sort of lacunae in the sampling for us to sort of really go the psychological role. But once we're still working with a set of a body of evidence within the sampling, I think we can avoid the psychologizing. I'm just throwing that out there. Yeah.
This is incredibly rich. I'd love to keep it going on, but I mean, right now, Jennifer is getting ready to interview Charles Nagy on the Atlas Society Asks, a professor fired from UCF for speaking out against woke narratives. At 8 p.m. Eastern tonight, Richard Salzman will be back hosting his Morals and Markets series, this one on how markets elevate our morals. And tomorrow, back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, like Professor Hill said, he's going to be discussing America in the Age of Nihilism. And we hope you're able to participate in those. You know, again, the Atlas Society Asks Charles Nagy is on now, so we hope you're able to do that. And we hope to be able to talk about this issue in depth further. There was some really rich information you guys were getting into at the end.